नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम हरे कृष्ण। टुडे वी आर रीडिंग फ्रॉम भगवद गीता एज इट इज चैप्टर नंबर 6 टेक्स्ट 18। दा विनियतम चित्तम आत्मान्येववतिष्ठते निस्पृह सर्वकामेभ्यो युक्ता इत्युचते तदा यदा divine, oh, first we'll do the word for word. Yada, when, translation by his divine Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. When the yogi, by practice of yoga, disciplines his mental activities and becomes situated in transcendence, devoid of all material desires, he is said to be well established in yoga. Report. The activities of the yogi are distinguished from those of an ordinary person by his characteristic cessation from all kinds of material desires, of which sex is the chief. A perfect yogi is so well disciplined in the activities of the mind that he can no longer be disturbed by any kind of material desire. This perfectional stage can automatically be attained by persons in Krishna consciousness, as stated in the Srimad Bhagavatam 9.4.18-20. Savaimana Krishna Padaravindayor Vachamsi Vaikunta Gunanu Varnane Karo Harer Mandhira Marjanadishu Shrutim Chakarya Chuta Sakkatodayi. King Ambarish first of all engaged his mind on the lotus feet of Lord Krishna, then, one after another, he engaged his words in describing the transcendental qualities of the Lord, his hands in mopping the temple of the Lord, his ears in hearing of the activities of the Lord, his eyes in seeing the transcendental form of the Lord, his body in touching the bodies of the devotees, his sense of smell in smelling the scents of the lotus flowers offered to the Lord, his tongue in tasting the tulasi leaf offered at the lotus feet of the Lord, his legs in going to places of pilgrimage and the temple of the Lord, his head in offering obeisances unto the Lord, and his desires in executing the mission of the Lord. All these transcendental activities are quite befitting a pure devotee. End quote. This may be inexpressible subjectively by the followers of the impersonalist path, but it becomes very easy and practical for a person in Krishna consciousness, as is apparent in the above description of the engagements of Maharaj Ambarisha. Unless the mind is fixed on the lotus feet of the Lord by constant remembrance, such transcendental engagements are not practical. In the devotional service of the Lord, therefore, these prescribed activities are called archana, or engaging all the senses in the service of the Lord. The senses and the mind require engagements. Simple abnegation is not practical. Therefore, for people in general, especially those who are not in the renounced order of life, transcendental engagement of the senses and the mind, as described above, is the perfect process for transcendental achievement, which is called yukta in the Bhagavad Gita. We'll read the next verse, 6:19. Yatadipo nivatasto ningate sopamasmrita yogino yatachittasya yunjato yogamatmanaha. As a lamp in a windless place does not waver, so the transcendentalist whose mind is controlled remains always steady in his meditation on the transcendent self. Purport. A truly Krishna conscious person, always absorbed in transcendence, in constant undisturbed meditation on his worshipable Lord, is as steady as a lamp in a windless place. Om. Translation again. When the yogi, by practice of yoga, disciplines his mental activities and becomes situated in transcendence, devoid of all material desires, he is said to be well established in yoga. As a lamp in a windless place does not waver, so the transcendentalist whose mind is controlled remains always steady in his meditation on the transcendent self. Let me begin by thanking all of you very much for being so steady in your own sadhana as to come visit the temple in spite of our monsoon deluge today, for making it all the way out here. It's our great pleasure to be able to share the purports of the Bhagavad Gita with you. It's interesting because today, in the verse, Maharaj Ambarish is being glorified for Karo Harer Mandira Marjanadishu. Mandira Marjana, which means the cleansing of the temple, and today, incidentally, happens to be the Gundicha Marjanam pastime of Lord Chaitanya. So we'll consider it a very auspicious beginning. The sixth chapter is generally quite bewildering to most devotees who come to this movement because it describes a very esoteric, austere practice of meditation, dhyana yoga, which involves moving to a secluded place, sitting on a deerskin mat, staring at the tip of one's nose, and simply concentrating one's mind on a single point. So for the average person today, we wouldn't even know where to obtain a deerskin rug, which store do you buy it in. We're not about to go kill our own deer. So it seems quite impractical. And this is the point that Srila Prabhupada is making in his verse. He says that Maharaj Ambarish is actually setting the example for all of us as to how we can make the teachings of the sixth chapter practical in our own lives. Because for one who's not in the renounced order of life, maybe you go to the river on the weekend to meditate, but it's not a sustainable activity or practice for someone in our position. So therefore, what is being described in the activities of Maharaj Ambarish is the complete dedication of the king's senses in the practice of Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti, which involves cleaning of the temple as one limb, for example. So the key to understand here is not so much that the yoga ladder that's being described and the practices involved are something which we need to adhere to a T. Because, as Arjuna demonstrates in the second chapter, he's complaining to Krishna that Guru Nahatvan Himahanubhava Shreyo Bhoktum Bhaikshama Piha Loke. He's saying that rather than kill Dronacharya, kill Bhishma Dev, these are sinful activities and will be tainted with blood. It's better for us to live in this world by begging, by the process of bhiksha or bhikshu, rather than to be engaged in killing. So what Arjuna is proposing to Krishna right from the second chapter is this process of Ashtanga Yoga. He wants to retreat to a quiet place far from the war cries and the din of battle and simply focuses his mind on the Lord. And yet we see towards the end of the Gita, by the time the 18th chapter rolls around, that by now Arjuna has changed his mind. He says, Nashto moha smritir labdha tvat prasadat maya chuta. He says, Sito smi gata sandeha karishi vachanam tava. Rather than escape to the forest like you recommended, now my illusion has been dispelled, my remembrance has come back, and therefore, free from all these doubts, I will do your order, Krishna, and I will fight. So the point is, Arjuna is demonstrating that this process of Ashtanga Yoga is actually inferior to the process of Bhakti Yoga. This is the same process that Maharaj Ambarish is demonstrating, that by following the rules and regulations under the guidance of superior spiritual authority, his spiritual master or the brahmanas, that one can attain all success without having to sit in Padmasana for 24 hours a day staring at the tip of one's nose. So we're getting an alternative. The whole process of Ashtanga Yoga is actually declared by Arjuna to be impossible, so difficult in this age. He says, Chanchalam himana Krishna pramati balavadridam, that this mind is so restless that even me, as a very powerful kshatriya living in Dwapara Yuga, can't possibly conceive of how I can perform this activity. And Krishna acknowledges, yes, for you, this is very difficult. And Arjuna is speaking in the Dwapara Yuga. You know, Arjuna, he was so much more qualified than us, having attended Gurukul right from the beginning of his life, performed austerities, hearing the whole Vedas. He was infinitely more qualified to control the mind, and yet he was himself conceding the difficulty involved. So this process of Dhyan Yoga is actually meant for Satya Yuga, where the Yuga Dharma for the age is Dhyan, is meditation. So what to speak of us today in Kali Yuga? How can we possibly imitate the activities of the Hamsas of Satya Yuga by adopting this very austere, difficult practice? It's not practical. So Lord Chaitanya, for this age of Kali Yuga, has declared that Yagyar Sankirtanay Prayair Yajanti Hi Sumedasaha, that those who are endowed with a little bit of intelligence will engage in the chanting of the holy names and the glorification of the Lord. So what we'll discuss is how Maharaj Ambarish has taken these teachings from the Bhagavad Gita and made them applicable in his own life, just like all of us can take these teachings of the sixth chapter and also become, as Krishna says in this verse, Nengate Sopamasmrita, that the mind can become very steady and very calm. So one of the major problems facing modern people of our age is a disturbed mind. That the biggest cause of mental disease in the coming decades will be stress, anxiety, insanity, depression, various problems of the mind, which Krishna is giving a nice solution to here. He says, by making the mind steady, like a flame in a windless place, then one has some chance of being engaged steadily in spiritual activities and retreating from material activities and achieving the perfection of life. So we see that a flame, when there's some kind of wind, it's always bending this way, that way, it's making some noise, it's smoking, it has a chance of it being extinguished at any moment. Yet when it's settled in a windless place, the flame just burns very beautifully, steadily. And so this is the goal and the means by which we can have some chance of becoming happy or peaceful in this world is actually to develop this steady mind. And so how on earth do we attain this steady mind if we don't perform this Dhyan Yoga? Then what is our hope? And so this is explained very nicely in the Gurvashtakam prayers that we chant every morning, is in the same process of Shri Vigrahara Dhananityanana Shringaratan Mandira Marjanadu, that by the mercy of the spiritual master, he has given us what? He's given us the process of sadhana bhakti, and this involves the process of archana, which is deity worship. So what's the relationship between this deity worship and the meditation being described in this verse? Because in the same Gurvashtakam prayers in the previous verse, we hear that Mahaprabhur Kirtana Nritya Gita Varitram Adyan Manasoratena. So the spiritual master is experiencing the rasa of actually hearing the words of Mahaprabhu, of chanting in ecstasy, of meditation on the Lord's pastimes. This is how the Guru is being glorified. So to analyze these two verses conceptually, we could divide the second verse of Gurvashtakam as being on the platform of what's called the Bhagavat Marg, of simply on the platform of the soul, of the spirit. The spirit can connect directly with Krishna and be engaged in this form of meditation, because the soul itself has no bodily identifications, no bodily needs. The Bhagavat platform is more or less the platform where someone can sit the entire day, maybe eat a palm full of buttermilk, like our acharyas, can just meditate on the bank of the Ganga, is happy to live underneath a boat. What clothes does he wear? He's willing to take a cloth from a dead body from the crematorium and wear that around his body. He's willing to live in a bathroom, like our Gaurakishore Das Babaji has demonstrated. He's completely transcendental to any of the dualities of the material world. So this is the perfection of the Bhagavat Marg, which, if we're honest and introspective with ourselves, we have to admit that we couldn't tolerate this kind of lifestyle for a single day. How many of us want to live in the bathrooms? We can't really stand them not being cleaned for a single day. So therefore, because we haven't attained this level of purification yet, Krishna is very merciful and he gives us so many options. He says, no problem. If you can't be totally transcendental to the body in your present state, I don't blame you. Krishna is giving us an alternative, and this is what's called Pancharatra, or the Pancharatrik Marg. And so this is what's described by Narada Muni in his Narada Pancharatra. And one verse from that is this verse, Atashri Krishna Namadi. Atashri Krishna Namadi na bhavet grahyam indriya. Sivamukhihi jivado swayameva spuratyadaha. So the point is that simply by keeping our tongue engaged in Krishna service, our eyes engaged, all the senses, beginning with the tongue, when we put those in Krishna's service, then we can regulate our lives in such a way that even though we're engaged with our body, with our mind, with our activities, all these activities are directly connected to the Lord, and therefore, even though we may be moving externally, we're actually purifying all the senses to the point where eventually we can have this totally undisturbed state of pure, unalloyed meditation. So the Pancharatrik process is more is what's described through this pastime of Maharaj Ambarish. That Maharaj Ambarish is using his five karmendriya, his five knowledge acquiring senses, his jnanendriya, and his five working senses, Jai Shri Shri Radha Gopinath Bhagavan Ki Jai, and his mind. So his five working senses, five knowledge acquiring senses, and his mind, all these senses, Rishikena Rishikesha Sevanam Bhakti Ruchyate, he's actually sacrificing those senses and engaging them in serving the deity form of the Lord and the devotees of the Lord and in cleansing the temple of the Lord. So Maharaj Ambarish, even though he's a king living in an opulent palace, still he has the facility to become completely fixed and concentrate his mind on Krishna by using his body and his senses in the Lord's service. So this is Pancharatrik Marg. This is what's characterized from our perspective by one who either lives in the temple or worships deities at home very fervently and is always constantly thinking of how I can use my time in the day to directly serve the form of Radha Krishna or Lakshmi Narayan or Jagannath Baladev Subhadra or Gauranitai, of how we can keep our senses engaged in the Lord's service. So this is Pancharatra. It's for one who is not so inclined, who has additional material desires, who is not willing to live in the temple, or who has to work outside and wants additional facility, additional forms of enjoyment, rather than a strict brahminical lifestyle, one who wants to enjoy the lifestyle of the other varnas, then Krishna offers him the opportunity to engage in varnashram dharma. So first we had Bhagavat, then Pancharatrik, and thirdly we have varnashram. So this varnashram system gives the rules and regulations by which anybody can perform their duties and their activities according to their conditioned nature for the means of gradually becoming purified of one's attachment to that conditioned nature and eventually purifying the heart to the point where we can devote more and more activities to directly serving the Lord. So this means that Varnashram regulates all our relationships in life. You're the husband and the wife, the parents and the children, the master and the servant. All these activities of social life are given a form by which we can please Krishna by their performance. So through this process of Nishkama Karma Yoga, or performing these activities in Varnashram, one can gradually progress. So this is more or less the yoga ladder as being described by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, is that
if you can't surrender to me this instant. Krishna says in 12th chapter, Mamma Visha Manoyimam. He says, please just give your intelligence and mind to me this instant, and then you'll definitely come to me. One who is not ready to surrender to the Lord in the mood of the gopis or in the mood of the Brahmana Patnis, for example, then he's given the opportunity to rather perform this Abhyasena Yogina Tato, that you can perform Abhyasa Yoga or the practice of Sadhana Bhakti. So this is the next step down. And if you can't perform these kind of practices of deity worship, then you do your work and give all the results to me, like that. Work on my behalf. So, where does Maharaj Ambarish fit within this scheme that I've described? So, it's interesting because in the pastime of Maharaj Ambarish, we see that he's in control of the entire planet, the seven islands. And the planet is flourishing under his administration, under his guidance. Because he's perfectly ruling the kingdom according to the duties of a proper kshatriya. He's taking counsel, good advice from the brahmanas, and he's performing all the sacrifices which are necessary for prosperity and material abundance. Maharaj Ambarish is performing the duties of kshatriya very nicely, because it's described in order to invoke rains, he goes to the desert and he performs the proper sacrifices with all the yajnik brahmanas and the fire sacrifices in order to invoke rain. And so this activities of Maharaj Ambarish could be considered within the duties of a king, within Varnashram. But we see what Prabhupada is bringing out in this verse is, what does Maharaj Ambarish do in his own palace, on his own time? He is worshipping the deity of the Lord. He is tasting the tulsi leaves, smelling the flowers offered to the Lord, embracing the Lord's form with his eyes, hearing the pastimes of the Lord. So he's also engaged in this pancharatrik process. So for him, these two are going on simultaneously. And as well, by hearing the pastimes of the Lord from a bona fide source, from the brahmanas, for example, Maharaj Ambarish is actually incorporating aspects of the Bhagavat Marg, which is the hearing and chanting of the pastimes, activities, form, paraphernalia of the Lord. He's also incorporating the Bhagavat Marg in a regulated way in his own life. So, he's demonstrating how, as a Grihastha Kshatriya devotee, he can simultaneously engage all his activities from morning till evening, even his sleep to the Lord, like that. So this is very important because it highlights what Krishna is saying in the 7th chapter, when he says, Maya Sakta Mana Partha Yogam Yunjan Marashraya Asamshayam Samagramam Yatagnyasi Tach Trinu. He's saying, after the 6th chapter, where Krishna has definitively stated that the best yogi is one who abides in me always, who thinks of me within his own self, who is always engaged in Shraddhavan Bhajate Yomam, who's always worshipping me with great faith, he is the best yogi by far. Same Yukta Tamo Mataha. So rather than the Ashtanga yogi I've described in this verse, he's saying the bhakti yogi is the most elevated. And the next verse, what are the qualities of a bhakti yogi? Maya Sakta Mana Partha Yogam Yunjan Marashrayaha. That is, mind is fixed in Krishna consciousness, an undeviated thought or meditation on the Lord. And without any doubts, he's able to perform these activities. And Krishna importantly says, Yatagnyasasi Tach Trinu. Up till this point, in every chapter of the Gita, Arjuna has been posing questions to the Lord, expressing his own doubts about the process. He says, you're telling me to fight, but I'm not quite convinced. And Arjuna is asking for justifications and reasons from Krishna, whom he's accepted as his guru. And finally, in 7th chapter, Krishna is telling Arjuna, now it's time for you to listen to me. And significantly, Arjuna does not ask any questions in this chapter. He's simply listening as a submissive student to what Krishna has to explain to him. So this aspect of listening from the spiritual master is what every single aspiring devotee has to be engaged in. Shravanam,
the first limb of devotional service is also, Prabhupada explains, one of the most crucial, because it's only by hearing from a bona fide spiritual master, such as Shukadev Goswami, such as Srila Prabhupada, such as our own Guru Maharaj, such as advanced Vaishnavas, that we can actually be engaged in the process which is appropriate for us. Varnashram, Pancharatra, Bhagavat. In order to develop the steadiness that's described in this verse 619, Ningate Sopama Smrita, this unflickering candle, we have to be so confident that the activities that I'm performing right now with my senses, with my mind, with my words, is what's being desired of me by Krishna. He has spoken through His books, through His authoritative representative, and therefore I can steadily be fixed in these activities and without any doubts, simply continue day after day with the same activities. So this is so crucial because every one of us experiences unsteadiness in our own practice of devotional service. In the beginning, we're faced with so many doubts regarding faith. Is it really worth attending this Krishna temple? Should I really believe in this book? Does this have anything to offer me? So our faith is weak. But once the faith becomes a bit solidified, one moves on to take the association of devotees. But even that association in the beginning is unsteady. Maybe we'll come, you know, one Sunday and then skip the next week, and maybe I'll come for this yatra, or I don't know if I should come for the class tonight. The last speaker was a bit boring and I don't know who's speaking. So this unsteadiness is what plagues our devotional service, is that we don't have full confidence that these activities are really the best thing, best usage of my time. But when one becomes a little bit more fixed in the association of devotees, by continuous hearing, one develops additional faith, which then leads to the next step, which is bhajana kriya, which means that one actually adopts the practices of devotional service. And through this purification of practicing devotional service under the tutelage of a bona fide spiritual master, then one's heart becomes further cleansed, one develops further faith, and one then moves on to the next step, which is that real anartha nivritti, the real desire or fixation on cleansing one's heart of all these anarthas, of all these diseases which have taken root in our hearts, like lust, greed, anger. But then the problem is, the unsteadiness is still on this platform, where we see a really good-looking billboard or movie, or our friends are inviting us to come to this, watch this TV show, or there's so many distractions to read mundane literature, to engage in mundane hearing, and therefore that steadiness does not fully mature until we reach the stage of nishta, when one is actually fixed that I don't want to engage in any of these material activities anymore. All I want to do is connect everything to Krishna like that. So this is really the perfection of Bhagavad Gita, is to come to this point of Arjuna's level, where he has developed sufficient faith in Krishna's words, where he's willing to karisheva chanam tava, simply perform the orders of the Lord and become steady in that duty like that. So this is the challenge facing all of us as sadhakas. And in order to attain this level of steadiness, one requires very serious discipline in one's life, which Krishna describes as yada viniyatam chitam. So vinita or viniya means discipline. So this discipline is acquired by performance of duties under the instructions of the spiritual master. And Maharaj Ambarish's brahminical advisors have told him to worship the deity form of the Lord. And so that's his activities. So every day he's performing these pancharatrik rites. And the product of Maharaj Ambarish's steadiness in this service is that even though he's the emperor of the world, he's completely given up all sense of proprietorship over this planet and over all his trappings of his palace. So, for example, he says, Yenidam
Lushtravatsmritaha, that this planet to him is just like a stone. He's developed the same kind of vision as the yogi described in the sixth chapter, is that he sees a pebble, a stone, and gold as the exact same thing. He's completely impartial and indifferent to them. So this is yogic vision, is seeing all the material world as equivalent. But then one could very justifiably state that if you put the same pebble, stone, and gold in front of a stray dog on the street, the dog could also view them with equal vision. He would sniff the pebble, the stone, and the gold. He would conclude that none of them are edible, and therefore he has no interest, and therefore he moves on. And he might find, you know, some stool or something that captivates his senses far more. So the next verse of this yogic vision is that one sees all these animate, inanimate objects as the same. And it's actually said that the dog, when he sees a beautiful woman walking down the street, he just sees what might become a source of food for him. She might be carrying something nice for the dog to nibble on. And the woman herself, even though she's a supermodel who, you know, bewilders the minds of the teenage boy, for the dog, she's a potential source of his next meal if she gives him food or if she just dies right there. She herself could become his next meal because dogs are not averse to eating human beings if they're hungry enough. So therefore, this equal vision is also there from the dog's point of view. He doesn't discriminate between ugly, beautiful, rich, poor. All he cares about is his stomach. This is the lowest level of consciousness. So this is clearly not what Krishna is describing in Gita, is having the consciousness of a dog. What Krishna is describing is actually being able to connect these things with Krishna. So this is the special prerogative of the yogi fixed in knowledge, is that even though these stone and the gold may be simultaneously material and therefore of little value, both of them can be engaged in Krishna's service in different ways. So, by the principle of Yukta Vairagya, he says, Anasaktasya Vishayan Yatarhum Upayunjataha, that even though he's not attached to this nugget of gold, still, Yatarhum Upayunjataha, Arhat, it's actually worthy of Yunjatu, of actually being engaged in the Lord's service, that this gold can be connected to Krishna in a particular way. And this stone, it's also useful in Krishna's service, like scaring away a dog, for example, from the temple. So these yogic vision that's being described is what one is aspiring for and what eventually one eventually develops through this process of worshipping the deity. And this is the platform that Maharaj Ambarish has ascended to through purification of heart, is that he's become such a powerful devotee of the Lord, Maharaj Ambarish has. And he's performing his sacrifices, worshipping the brahmanas, and he decides to perform a year-long Ekadasi Vrata, wherein he decides to fast from certain foods, and at the conclusion of that year, he's about to break his fast in the one auspicious muhurta, when all of a sudden, out of nowhere, appears one of the greatest, most renowned ascetics in the universe, Durvasa Muni. And Durvasa Muni is offered a seat, he's offered all respect, he's offered something to eat. So Ambarish Maharaj is performing his proper duties by extending hospitality to this great sage. And Durvasa explains that before I will honor prasad, I will go perform my ablutions in the river, I will go meditate and chant my Gayatri. And so, please, if you can postpone this meal for some time, I'll be right back. And so, Durvasa Muni, he makes his way to the river. And Ambarish Maharaj, in the meantime, realizes, according to his calculations, that the auspicious muhurta for breaking his fast is upon him. And that if he does not break his fast at this instant, then the product or the fruit of his fasting will have been completely spoiled, that his vow will have failed. And so in distress, Ambarish Maharaj consults his Brahminical advisors who explain to him that actually the drinking of water is non-different from eating. It can be considered either eating or not eating. It's the unique quality of water. So therefore, he recommends to Ambarish Maharaj to drink water and therefore not suffer the consequence of having performed this great transgression of religion by eating before his yogi guest. So the tension with Ambarish Maharaj is whether I should break my fast or whether I should break the codes of hospitality by eating before my guest. So very much with the desire to satisfy all the rules of dharma, he's confused in his duty. And this is similarly the position Arjuna is in the beginning of Gita, when he says, Karpanya doshopahata svabhava prichamitvam dharma samuda chetaha. Dharma samuda, he's confused as to what I should do. But Arjuna submits this decision to Krishna, his guru, in the same way that Ambarish Maharaj submits this decision to his advisors like that. Yet in spite of all this good counsel, when Durvasa Muni eventually returns from his bath, by dint of his mystic powers, he can detect that Maharaj Ambarish has broken his fast, that he's actually drunk water, enjoyed his senses before his guest. And therefore, in order to punish Maharaj Ambarish for this adharmic behavior, Durvasa Muni, by employing his powerful mysticism, he rips some hair out of his head, dashes it to the ground, and out emerges a ferocious demon. And this demon is set on destroying Maharaj Ambarish. And it's explained in this pastime that in spite of this horrible demon who's about to devour our king, still Maharaj Ambarish is completely unflinching. He doesn't fear for a moment for his own life, and he simply watches the demon approach him. So this fearlessness exhibited by Maharaj Ambarish is actually the quality of a sannyasi, as described in Gita. In the 16th chapter, it's described, Abhayam sattva samshuddhir jnana yoga vyavastitihi, that the sannyas is abhayam, completely fearless in all activities, out of complete dependence on the Lord, by dint of his surrender, and surrender is characterized by rakshishyatiti vishvaso guptitve varanam tata, that two limbs of surrender is to consider the Lord as one's maintainer, that he will nourish me, feed me, I need not worry about my next meal. And this aspect of rakshishyatiti, that he's actually dependent that the Lord will protect me and defend me in all circumstances. Ambarish Maharaj, even though he's involved in the life of a king with all the appurtenances of a royal splendor, still he's a yogi or a sannyasi at heart because of his complete dependence on the Lord. As in the 6th chapter, anashrita karma phalam karyam karma karoti yaha, that he's completely detached from any of these karmic activities. He's not even attached to his own life. So sasanyosi cha yogi cha nani ragnino na chakriyaha. Maharaj Ambarish has attained the sannyas level of renunciation and detachment as exhibited by his total fearlessness in face of this demon approaching. Similarly, we find Prahlad Maharaj, who is just a little child, has similar amount of fearlessness. So this is one of the products of our own personal devotional lives, is when we come to the point where we don't stress any further about money problems and all these problems of eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. When one is willing to perform one's duties and simply understand that the Lord will satisfy all my needs, because why wouldn't He? He's the supreme controller of everything. Sarva Loka Maheshwaram. Why should the Lord not feed me? Why should He not clothe me? Why should He not shelter me? When this level of renunciation is reached, one has attained to this platform of sannyas, one can understand. So therefore, our Maharaj Ambarish, what happens next is that as this demon is about to finish Ambarish Maharaj's life, out of the sky, out of nowhere, the Sudarshan Chakra appears. Vishnu's blazingly powerful heat weapon, the Sudarshan Chakra, immediately kills the demon, chops his head off, and then proceeds to chase our Durvasa Muni, who out of her spite runs all over the universe seeking to escape the heat of this chakra like that. So we see that Durvasa Muni, even though he's such an austere tapasvi, perhaps he's performed this Ashtanga Yoga process to such a perfection that he has actually gained these mystic powers, that he can create a demon out of his hair, that he has the power to curse a king. Even though he's performed so much austerity, he's definitely stared at the tip of his nose, sat on his own deerskin mat in a secluded place for so many long years, has he actually gained the favor of the Lord? Has he actually exceeded Maharaj Ambarish in his own spiritual advancement? And clearly the answer is no. The point that's being made in Bhagavatam is that time and time again, so many of these rishis and these yogis are falling victim to their own anarthas, their own greed, their own lust, their own anger, their own vindictive mentality. Like, for example, in the ninth canto after the Maharaj Ambarish pastime, there's the pastime of Sobhadi Rishi, who is a great yogi meditating for tens of thousands of years underwater, who has attained such a level of sense control that he's no longer dependent on oxygen for his subsistence. He can simply extract the oxygen from the water molecules himself and retain his life airs in that manner for thousands of years. So he's actually even covered himself in barnacles and seaweed. That's how long he's been underwater. And yet, with the agitation of the mind, by simply seeing a she-fish and a he-fish reproducing, he has so much agitation of mind that he has to abandon his asceticism, return to the land, and he decides to reject his yogic process and follow the path of a worldly enjoyer by marrying 50 wives. So a great yogi has fallen from the path simply because his activities are not connected to the Lord. He thought that by the strength of my own austerity, by my own ascetic merit, I can attain peace of mind. And clearly, in the pastime of Durvasa Muni, we see that this is not the case. Because, as Krishna states in Bhagavatam, he says that, yasyasti bhaktir bhagavatya kinchana sarvair gunar tatra samasati sura. He says that one can acquire all the qualities of the demigods. The demigods actually reside inside of one who has simply dedicated one's activities to the Lord. But one who has failed to worship the Lord, in him, no good qualities can ever appear by dint of his own mental speculation. So we see that Durvasa Muni, he hasn't acquired any good qualities in spite of his Jnana Yoga, in spite of his perfection of by following the process of Yam, Niyam, Asana, Pranayam, Pratyahara, Dharana, Dhyan, Samadhi. In spite of this rigorous process, he hasn't actually attained the favor of the Lord, attained to the mercy of the Lord, and now he's regretting his life's activity because his life is in danger. The Lord is coming after him with a vengeance. One who offends the Lord's devotee has no chance of success in this world or in the next. And this is what's coming out in this pastime. So, Maharaj Ambarish eventually is feeling very merciful towards this Durvasa Muni, even though he's decided to curse him out of spite. Lord Vishnu explains to Durvasa that the only recourse you have is to apologize and to beg the forgiveness of my great devotee, whom you've offended, Ambarish Maharaj. And so Durvasa, he repents his ways. He decides to beg forgiveness at the lotus feet of Ambarish Maharaj, and in this way becomes absolved of his great crime. So, in all cases, by connecting one's activities to the Lord, by begging the forgiveness of the Lord for one's wrongdoings, by submitting ourselves to the Lord, by hearing from the Lord's devotees, all activities in life become auspicious, and one need never fear. Maharaj Ambarish is demonstrating that even though he wasn't a great yogi, he was a great devotee. In spite of that, he attained the supreme perfection of life because by engaging in his activities within the household, he has nonetheless become completely detached from material, completely attached to the spiritual. He has realized his own eternal position as the Lord's servitor, and in this way has, at the end of his grahastha life, taken to the vanaprastha ashram, and along with his wife, they have completely renounced worldly affairs, and both of them perfect their lives and go back home, back to Godhead in this life. So what we observe in this pastime is that even though the practice of Dhyana Yoga, as it's formulated here, in terms of the strict practice of asanas in a quiet place and the restraint of the breath, the principle is not the form. The principle is the sacrifice involved. And additionally, the actual purification of mind which takes place. So even though we may not externally follow the path that Krishna has described in this sixth chapter, as evidenced by Maharaj Ambarish, we still have to practice and advance in the same level of knowledge, the same level of renunciation. Knowledge and renunciation is the principal advancement and not the external activities. So therefore, this detachment and this fixity of mind must develop in the sadhaka eventually. It's the goal we're all striving for. Maybe our process is not to sit in the forest or sit in a cave. Our process may be, just like Ambarish Maharaj, to sweep the floor of the Lord, to be engaged in making flower garlands for the Lord, for cooking for the Lord. All these are also austerities. For performing the arati ceremony, for waking up, chanting, you know, singing for the Lord, dancing for the Lord, these are all austerities that we must perform because they've been given to us by our Srila Prabhupada. He's given us the process by which we can attain to the same level of peace of mind and of steadiness as described in the sixth chapter, but by adopting this process of the Pancharatrika Vidhi like this. So therefore, it's incumbent upon us to be performing all these activities with this knowledge of the ultimate goal of where we want to go. Because otherwise, one can get attached to the rituals of temple worship, and if it's performed without knowledge, then there's very little benefit. As we've all experienced, some of our parents or grandparents or predecessors may have been very attached to visiting the temple, to chanting these mantras, to doing these sacrifices, but when pressed for a reason, why on earth is it necessary for us to wave this candle at the Lord, to offer this water at the Lord? It looks to me just like a stone. So why on earth should we be dedicating our activities to this nicely dressed stone, one may actually ask? And if the knowledge is not involved in this ritual, then one may, out of sentiment, be engaged in performing these activities day in, day out. One may have attachment to tradition, attachment to culture, attachment to the opinions of our peers in society. And out of this sentiment, one may remain engaged in some religious activities, pious life. But the problem is, if one is attached simply on a sentimental platform, then there's every possibility of renouncing that activity also on the sentimental platform. So sentiment is not actually a solid basis for advancement in Krishna consciousness, because sentiment is very weak. As soon as someone may come along with a better proposition for sense gratification, a better proposition for economic development, an alternative for liberation even, then by the force of their arguments, we may actually find our faith become very shaky, and we may give up religious life, we may give up pious life, simply because another alternative has presented itself, which sounds more appealing. So this is the emphasis being given in Bhagavad Gita, is to perform our duties in knowledge. So finally, if we were to really understand deeply what is the essence of Bhagavad Gita, it can be summarized by the performance of one's duties in knowledge, remembering Krishna for Krishna. Four aspects, more or less, is the discharge of our prescribed duties is the first aspect. But as we've seen, simply performing our karma is not enough. It has to be done in knowledge. Because as Krishna says, Jnane parisamapyate, that sarvepyate yajnavido yajyakshapita kalmachah, one who is engaged in all these yajyas, but who's yajnavido, who knows the purpose of these yajyas, yajyakshapita kalmachah, all the dirt and contamination within his heart becomes cleansed through this knowledge. That just like fire is burned to ashes, or sorry, firewood is burned to ashes by the fire, similarly, yanagni sarva karmani bhasmasat kurute tata. Similarly, by the force of knowledge, all the reactions from our karma are burned to ashes, and one actually advances and progresses in knowledge. So the dynamic factor in our activities is not simply the body being engaged, but also the intelligence being engaged, also the mind being engaged. So, discharge of prescribed duties, but in knowledge. What is this knowledge? Knowledge of the self, knowledge of the modes of material nature, knowledge that I'm not the doer, knowledge that Krishna is the ultimate beneficiary of all our activities, Krishna is the ultimate controller, and this vision that everyone is equal on the spiritual platform. This is the knowledge with which our activities, our karma, will actually bear fruit of knowledge. So Baladev Vijayabhushan explains that. How do we understand the difference between the karma yoga and the jnana yoga being described in Bhagavad Gita thus far? He explains that it's just like you have rice paddy. When rice is being cultivated, it always comes in a husk. And within that husk is the actual rice. The husk in and of itself is inedible and is undesirable. But without the husk, there is no possibility of the rice grain actually developing. So therefore, the karma is described to the husk, and the jnana, or the knowledge, is described to the grain. So both are necessary, both are required, but ultimately, we're interested in eating a bowl of rice, not a bowl of husks. So that is the driving factor behind our karma, is this transcendental knowledge that's described in the fourth chapter. Then in the fifth chapter, more aspects of this meditation are introduced at the end, is that the process of supersoul meditation, of actually thinking about Krishna, is described. And then at the end of the sixth chapter, we find that Krishna is introducing himself as being the one, or the proper beneficiary of all our activities. So the karma is there in terms of our duties, the jnana is there in terms of the knowledge in which the duties were formed, the dhyana is there in terms of the acknowledgement of the paramatma, of the supersoul. And finally, the bhakti becomes prominent when one understands that this supersoul is actually Krishna in his two-armed form, and that he should be the one whose pleasure we're pursuing. Because karma is motivated by a fruit of result, karma phal. The jnana is motivated by impersonal liberation. And simultaneously, the Ashtanga Yoga is also motivated by this desire for mystic cities, just like Durvasa Muni developed, just like our Sobari Rishi developed. So in every case, these kinds of yogas are actually covered over by some kind of selfish desires. But only bhakti can be purely performed for the sake of someone else, can be purely unalloyed. And this is the perfection of bhakti yoga that we are all aspiring for.
is this anyabhilashita shunyam jnana karma adyanavritam anukulyena krishnanu shilanam bhaktir uttama, that one must be completely devoid of the karma, the jnana, and adi. Adi means the desires for yogic benefits, that one's bhakti must be anavritam, not covered by these activities. So as Maharaj Ambarish is demonstrating, one can still perform the karma, one can still cultivate knowledge, one can still meditate on the Lord, but none of these activities should overshadow or should become more prominent than what? That singular desire to please Krishna. What is this? Anukulena Krishna Anushilanam. That our activities must be performed without hostility for the Lord. They must be performed for the Lord's pleasure. And they must be following the culture or the prescribed activities as elaborated by the Lord. So in this connection we see that here's the definition of pure devotional service. But how do all the devotees of the Lord? We have our Yashoda Ma over here. And she's making the Lord cry in this very painting here. She's actually pulled out her whipping stick. Krishna is crying tears. He's breathing faster. And he's running all over the place out of fear of his mother. So is this actually giving pleasure to Krishna? She's actually disturbing his mind greatly. Or we have someone who's actually giving pleasure to Krishna, but is doing it with a hostile attitude. And in this respect, we have our Shishupal, our Dantavakra. All these devotees, or Jarasandha too, are actually engaging in battle, waging war against the Lord in Mathura. They're firing arrows at the Lord, trying to kill his horses, kill his devotees, kill all his citizens of his town. And how is Krishna responding to this? He's experiencing Viryaras. He's actually relishing the joy and the adrenaline and the rasa of actually being engaged in this fighting like that. So even though they're so opposed to the Lord, they want to kill Krishna, they're actually giving Krishna pleasure. So how does our definition accord with these two examples? So what's actually the qualification of this devotional service, a pure unalloyed devotional service, is that we can't be like Jarasandha and want to kill Krishna, even though we may be thinking of him, even though we may be performing duties for that are prescribed for his pleasure, it's still not enough. It has to be done with this mood of pure unalloyed love, that we want to please Krishna's senses. And for Yashoda Mata, we actually see that the disturbance in Krishna's face and body is actually a symptom of great pleasure. He's actually enjoying this pastime, experiencing the love of his mother, because she's not doing out of hostility. The pot of milk is boiling over, and she's thinking, how will I be able to feed my little Krishna sweets if I spoil the milk here? So she's willing to put Krishna down at that moment. Everything is being motivated out of pure unalloyed devotional service. So by this qualification, we see that she is still performing pure and unalloyed bhakti like this. So, in conclusion, this is what our aspiration is in bhakti yoga. And we should not get distracted by these descriptions, thinking that this jnana yoga is too difficult, but simply by placing our faith in the process that Srila Prabhupada has given us, then we have a chance of actually attaining to our eternal benefit. Because as it's described, Brahmanda Brahmiti Kona Bhagyavan Jiva Guru Krishna Prasadipai Bhakti Lata Beej. That one becomes very fortunate by coming across the teachings of the Lord or of his devotee, because he gives us the seed of devotional service, this Bhakti Lata Beej. And what is this seed? This seed is this Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti. At our level, this is what we need to do. There's no need to become bewildered by all the Shastra, if we simply place our faith in our own preceptor, Srila Prabhupada, who has so kindly explained the esoteric meaning of this verse in the sixth chapter by appealing to Maharaj Ambarish, who has given all of us a very nice example which all of us can follow. We need not deprive our senses, starve our senses of enjoyment, because the senses naturally, the tongue wants to taste something, the eyes want to see something beautiful, ears want to hear something. The nature of the mind and senses is actually enjoyment. So by following in the footsteps of Maharaj Ambarish, we can lead a life
full of pleasure in Krishna consciousness, as Krishna says, that susukam kartum avyayam. It's full of pleasure at every step.
Hare Krishna. So would any of you have any questions or comments for us today? Yes, wanted to.
Hare Ram, Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Yes, I did get that question when you talked about the flame attaining the steadiness in the windless space. How to attain that, how to get that peace and steadiness by Bhakti Yoga. Yeah. But then the question comes, when is that point? Or which is the point when we experience that steadiness? How are we going to understand that? When? And what is that experience?
The means of attaining this steadiness, to answer the first part of your question, as explained very beautifully by Prabhupada in the second chapter, when he explains, Vyavasayatmika buddhi ekeha kuru nandana. That this buddhi, intelligence, must become fixed in one pointed. Ekeha kurunandana. Bahu shaka hyanantascha buddhayo vyavasayin. That when one's mind is splayed all over the place, bahu shaka, like a tree with branches going in every direction, that one's mind can never be peaceful when one has so many different priorities in life, so many different options and alternatives. One can never find this peace. So in order to detect when one is actually in a peaceful state or the steadiness is attained, one can detect it because one is confident in all of one's activities, that one no longer suffers from doubts about what one is supposed to do or what one is not supposed to do, because one is fixed on this one singular goal of simply trying to please my spiritual master. The purport Prabhupada gives to this verse, Vyavasayatmika buddhi, is that it's only possible for a devotee in Krishna consciousness who is actually following in a bona fide line of disciplic succession. When we have an order and when we have instruction from our spiritual master, life becomes easy. No more stressing about what to do, what not to do. One can actually, with confidence, perform activities in a very natural and happy way. Even though they may be difficult, one no longer suffers from doubts. And so, this is something that every one of us experiences, is like the so many choices are available about what to do. You go to the supermarket and you're overwhelmed with like 10 different kinds of toothpaste. You want to buy a cleaning product and there's 30 varieties. And even though today we've been given so much material opulence in terms of what kind of brand of car you want to buy, or what of the 300 channels on TV you want to watch, or at the multiplex, how many movies are there, which one should I watch, which movie should I rent, which website should I visit, which news should I listen to, this is actually engenders a very agitated mind, because one is always worried about one's sense gratification. But when one's happiness is actually found within, then in spite of so much choice that's being offered to us out there, one can be confident in knowing that none of this has anything to offer me. I can be fixed in this flame, this spiritual flame within my heart, that simply by very carefully keeping this flame sheltered from all this windy agitation, simply by performing my sadhana nicely, serving the orders of my spiritual master nicely, I don't have to worry about what anybody thinks about me. I don't have to care about this person laughing or these people, you know, questioning my activities, because I'm confident, I have faith that this flame is enough to keep me satisfied like that. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Other questions? Jai Hare Krishna. Thank you very much for your time. Srila Prabhupada ki, Radha Gopinath ki. श्रीमद् भगवद्गीता की जय गुंडीचा मार्जना की जय हरि बोल